Well, few chapters of the Bible are as controversial as the very first chapter. I avoided the controversy last week by staying in the safety of the first half of the first verse. But I can't stay there forever. I do need to venture out into the minefield of the 6 days of creation. Now, I know that I'm not going to please all of you here with what I say. So polarized is the debate over this first chapter that I think it impossible to preach through it or teach through it without offending one side or the other, or perhaps both sides. So how are we to read Genesis chapter 1? What sort of literature is it? Is it history? Is it myth? Is it to be taken literally or read literarily? Well, let me first make some comments about the literary features of Genesis in general and chapter 1 in particular. And you'll have to judge whether I calm down or stir up the waters with these comments. The book of Genesis is structured into 10 major sections by a heading that occurs 10 times. This is the account of, or these are the generations of. These 10 accounts are divided into two sets of 5. The first 5 cover primeval history, largely chapters 2 through 11. And the second set of 5 cover the patriarchal history, largely chapters 12 through 50. In each set of 5, the odd accounts are narratives and the even accounts are shorter genealogies. So in the first set, the accounts of the heavens and the earth, of Noah and of Shem, are interleaved with the genealogies of Adam and the sons of Noah. In the second set, the longer narratives of Terah, Isaac, and Jacob are interleaved with the shorter genealogies of Ishmael and Esau. And in this series, we're going to cover the first 5 accounts, the primeval history. Now, the reason I mention this at this point is because the first account doesn't begin until chapter 2, verse 4. Therefore, chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 3, stands outside the main structure of the book. It serves as an introduction to the whole book. One might say as an introduction to the whole Bible. I should point out that chapter divisions were not added to the Bible until the 13th century by Stephen Langton, and they were added for convenience in referencing the Bible. They're not inspired. Chapter divisions do not always coincide with logical divisions within the text. And the very first chapter division, that between Genesis 1 and 2, is in the wrong place. So whenever I refer to chapter 1, please assume that I'm including the first 3 verses of chapter 2. So the opening creation story is not to be read the same way as the 10 accounts. I mentioned that 4 of the accounts are genealogies. The other 6 are narratives that employ standard Hebrew narrative style. From the point of view of language, there is nothing to distinguish the patriarchal narratives from the primeval narratives. The narrative expects me to take Abram, Jacob, Joseph as historical, and likewise to take Adam and Noah as historical. There's nothing in the Hebrew style that would allow me to accept the second 5 as historical and the first 5 as non-historical. But Genesis 1 is different. It is narrative, but it is narrative that is so crafted that it's halfway to poetry. Now, I'm a little old-fashioned in my understanding of what constitutes poetry. It is not narrative with random carriage returns inserted. I'm struck by the first definition that's given on dictionary.com. Poetry is, quote, the art of rhythmical composition, written or spoken, for exciting pleasure by beautiful, imaginative, or elevated thought. Now, that certainly applies to this chapter. It has rhythm, pattern, structure. We should therefore read it as poetry and not as narrative. You see, when we read a good poem, we savor the words. We appreciate the structure. We feel the beat of the meter. We delight in the word plays. We feel a poem in a way that is not true of a straight narrative. And if you reduce this chapter to straight narrative, then you misread it. You won't feel it as it should be felt. I'll elaborate on this further when we look at the days themselves. So Genesis 1 stands outside the general structure of the book, and it is not to be read as straightforward narrative, but as poetry. This first section of Genesis, this introduction to the whole book, has five sections. A summary statement in verse 1, the statement of the initial state of the earth in verse 2, the 6 days of creation, verses 3 through 31, another summary statement in chapter 2, verse 1, and then an epilogue about the seventh day, chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. Today we'll look at the initial state and the first 3 days. The chapter opens with a summary statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And this is balanced by a concluding summary statement in chapter 2, verse 1. Thus, the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. Here, the heavens and the earth is a merism, encompassing the totality of all things, the whole cosmos. God created everything. Now, I said last week that these early chapters of Genesis can be read as a polemic against the stories of the surrounding cultures. These chapters were given to Israel as their account of origins over against the stories of the Babylonians, of the Canaanites, of the Egyptians. These accounts typically contain three elements: a theogony, namely a creation of the gods and the invisible realm they occupy; a cosmogony, that is, the creation of the visible physical world, the cosmos; and then the creation of mankind. And the most famous of these accounts is the Babylonian Enuma Elish. It opens with a theogony, an account of the creation of the gods and of their realm. From the intermingling of pre-existent freshwater and saltwater, who are Apsu and Tiamat, were born six gods, the last of them being Ea, the subterranean freshwaters. Now, these six gods were a rowdy lot, and they disturbed the peace of Apsu, and he plotted to kill them. But Ea, the last of these six gods created, killed him. Ea then fathered Marduk, the storm god. Then it was Tiamat's turn to be disturbed and robbed of her peace by these six rowdy gods. She plotted to kill them, appointing Kingu as her commander, but Marduk killed her and captured Kingu. So that's the theogony, the creation of the gods. The account then moves on to cosmogony, creation of the cosmos. Marduk took Tiamat's body, sliced it in half, and created the cosmos from the two halves of her body. The gods acclaimed him as king, and he ordered a temple built for himself in Babylon. And then we have the creation of mankind, and Marduk's suggestion that humans be created to relieve the gods of their labor. The gods then made humans out of Kingu's blood. Now, that might all sound a little confusing, and that's a reflection of the Babylonians' world. The Enuma Elish expresses how the Babylonians understood their world. Their spiritual world was inhabited by multiple gods who were at war with each other. These gods were capricious and unpredictable. Their world was chaotic. And so you as a human, your work was to try and get the gods onto your side, to get them to look favorably upon you. The physical world was then birthed out of conflict between good and evil. There was no guarantee that good would prevail. Evil was always threatening to overwhelm the world. And then finally, humans were created to do the grunt work for the gods. Only the king had a special status. You see, such creation stories shaped how people saw everything, how they saw themselves, how they saw others, how they saw their world, and how they saw their gods. But how different is the Genesis account? There is no theogony. Instead, in the beginning, God. Though evil will intrude into the world, it is not a divine force, equal and opposite to God. There is no primeval struggle between good and evil. Some of our understandings of Satan come dangerously close to this view. We magnify the power and status of Satan. No, the cosmos came into being because God created it as a free act of his love and pleasure, not because he had to, or as a result of conflict, but because he wanted to, and he takes delight in the world he has made. It is very good. Well, the summary statements in the opening verses of chapters 1 and 2 present the creation of an ordered and filled cosmos. They don't describe how God did that. They just present it. verses 2 through 31 then give a poetic account of the making of that ordered and filled cosmos, beginning with the initial state in verse 2. Now the earth was formless and empty, darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Here, the earth must mean the entire physical cosmos, the planet plus all of the surrounding space. We're not told how this came into being. This is presumably covered under the God's creation of the heavens and the earth. But we are told of the initial state in a threefold statement. The earth was formless and void. The artful, delicious-sounding Hebrew phrase, tohu vavohu. The earth was formless. It had no structure. The earth was void. It had no contents. Being formless, it was uninhabitable. Being void, it was uninhabited. Now, this is not a state subsequent to verse 1, that the whole cosmos was created but then became formless and void, degenerating into chaos. This so-called gap theory was popularized by the notes in the Scofield Bible, and it still lingers on. It assumes a lengthy gap between verses 1 and 2, which has become a convenient dumping ground for all manner of things that don't fit anywhere else, including the dinosaurs and the ape men, and most notably, the fall of Satan. But the gap theory has no merit at all. Verse 2 cannot be translated, then the earth became formless and void. No, verse 2 describes the initial blank state rather than a subsequent negative state. The second statement then tells us that two elements were present, darkness and the deep. Perhaps we should describe them as non-elements, as nothings. For in the biblical view, darkness is the absence of light and deep is the absence of safe land. Both represent absence of formation. Now, once the earth has been formed, both then represent reversion to unformation, to uncreation, descent into disorder. In Canaanite mythology, darkness and sea, Choshech and Yam, are malevolent forces, evil deities, threatening to overwhelm the world. But here, they are simply initial states of uncreation, which flee at God's command. And then the third statement tells us that God's Spirit was already present, hovering over the waters of the deep, as a mother bird hovers over the young in her nest, ready to execute the purposes of God as he speaks order. So here then is the initial state at the start of the 6 days of creation, formless and void. And in 6 days, God will reverse this state. In the first 3 days, he will form the cosmos, and in the second 3 days, he will fill it. The bulk of chapter 1 is the recital of these 6 days of creation. The language here is poetic, highly structured, artful. The most obvious structure is the 6 days themselves. There is rhythm to these verses. Each day follows a similar pattern, a similar rhythm with 6 elements. Starting with a divine command, then God said, the resultant creative act, then a statement of fulfillment, and it was so. Then a naming, then God called, followed by an evaluation. Then God saw that it was good, and a conclusion. And there was evening, and there was morning, the nth day. This rhythm is obvious to all who read this chapter. But the text has a much richer texture to it. These 6 days form 2 triads, each of 3 days, and the various rhythmic elements are distributed across these 6 days in a highly significant manner. 10 times we read, then God said. Once on the first day of each set, once on the second day, and then 2 times on the third day, and 4 times on the 6th day, for a total of 10 words. God fashions the world in 8 creative acts, 1 on each of the first 2 days, and 2 on the 3rd day of each set. There are 7 statements of fulfillment, once on the 1st day, once on the 2nd day, and 2 times on the 3rd day of each set, except that the statement is omitted on day 2 of the 2nd set in order to achieve a 7-fold statement of fulfillment. Likewise, there are 7 statements that God saw that it was good. Again, once on the first day, once on the second day, twice on the third day, except this time it's the second day of the first set that has that statement omitted. Again, in order to achieve this sevenfold proclamation. Finally, it is only on the first set of 3 days that God names what he has made. In the second set, this element is omitted because God will delegate that task to the human. So, we have 10 words, 7 declarations of fulfillment, 7 declarations of goodness, 2 similar sets of 3 days. This is not a normal narrative. These rhythmic repetitions carry meaning, for of course 7 and 10 are highly significant numbers, symbolic of fullness, of perfection, of completion. We should not read this as a scientific textbook. We should read it as we do a poem, rolling it around and around on our lips and in our mind, and its imaginative beauty should excite pleasure. Listen, therefore, as I read the account of the first 3 days. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. God called the vault sky, and there was evening and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. So do you feel the rhythm of this poem? God spoke his world into being using 10 words. On the first day, he said, "Let there be light." And there was light. This is creation by divine fiat. Fiat is the Latin word that means "let it be," the verb that's used here. The Hebrew Bible has an exalted view of the Word of God. But the New Testament has an even more exalted view, recognizing that the Word is the Son. God creates through his Word. God creates through his Son. Here again, we are on holy ground, as we explored last week. This drama of God speaking light into a dark world is well captured in the sacred oratorio Creation by Haydn. Perhaps some of you are familiar with this. It opens with an orchestral overture, a portrayal of the initial chaos, the initial lack of order in the world. And then proceeds to the first day, and after a recitative, the chorus joins in, singing in a very calm voice, "In the Spirit God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was." And at that point, the orchestra lets loose, the choir lets loose, they play and they sing at the top of their voice as they say, "light," to illustrate this sharp, sudden imposition of light into a world of darkness. Very dramatic effect, wonderful. Captures the intent of the text here. Now, I can't make things this way. I've spent much of the past 2 weeks working on our house, but the house doesn't take shape at my command. I've been rewiring the house, and Friday I had the power off until 6 o'clock at night. And as darkness fell at 5 o'clock, I wished I could have said, "Let there be light." But I can't. I struggled on in the gloom and darkness till I could finally turn on the master breaker at 6 o'clock, by which time it was well and truly dark. But God can. He speaks, and it happens. He says, "Let it be," and it is. How? I don't know. Genesis 1 doesn't tell me. And I really have no capacity for knowing, for understanding. Now, how could there be light on day one if the sun, moon, and stars are not created until day four? This is a standard question, but it is the wrong question to ask. Those who ask it are trying to read the chapter as a science book. Theologically, biblically, there is no difficulty. For at the end, in the new heavens and the new earth, there will be no need for sun and moon. Yet the light will be more radiant than ever. For God himself is the light, and the Lamb is the Lamb. From a literary point of view, the creation poem allocates light to the forming of the world, and the light-bearing bodies to the filling of the world on day four. You see, biblically, there is much more to light than the photons emitted by the sun and reflected by the moon. Light is a metaphor for order, darkness for disorder. And if you insist on reading chapter one as a science book and think in terms of photons, you're going to miss the point of the chapter. In speaking light into darkness, God speaks order. God continues this ordering on days two and three. On day two, he speaks into existence a firmament, an expanse, or a vault that separates the waters above from those below. And he names this vault the sky. On day three, the waters flee at his command so that dry land emerges. He separates land from sea. And then in a second creative act on the third day, God commands the vegetation. Again, people ask, how can there be vegetation before the sun? How can there be vegetation without photosynthesis? Again, it's the wrong question. Plants are viewed as part of the structure of the world rather than its contents. So the real question is, why are the plants included in the first set, the forming of the world, rather than in the second set, the filling of the world? They're part of the structure that supports life. So in four acts on 3 days, God forms the world that started out unformed. He gives it structure, shape, order. As Haydn's Creation puts it in the aria after the recitative on day one, confusion yields and order shines most fair. That's the spirit of the text. Well, what about these days? How long are they? Advocates of 24 hours point out that this is the natural meaning of the word day, the Hebrew word yom. Day age advocates appeal to the statement that a day is like 1,000 years in the Lord's sight. So which do I take? I know there are advocates of both positions out here in the congregation today wanting to know what I'm going to say. Well, I say a plague on both houses. Both are trying to read this chapter as a science book. Both misread scripture. Let day stand as day and read this as poetry. Well, then, am I a young earth, six-day creationist, or an old earth evolutionist? Again, I know that both are present here this morning and want to know what I say, but again, it's the wrong question. Genesis 1 is not written to present a young earth, six-day creationist position, nor an old earth evolutionist position. And both sides misuse it by reading it as a science book. Now, on the one hand, I am interested in the work of the Institute of Creation Research down in San Diego. A few years ago, I brought in an ICR speaker here. I'm glad that there are PhD scientists doing research within a creationist framework, as long as their science is good science. But I do object to reading Genesis 1 as a science book. I object to the way that people who hold that position try and conform Genesis 1 into their views and make it say things that it was never intended to say. On the other hand, there are people who advocate the day-age theory, who want to hold on to a very old earth and try and make Genesis 1 fit into that position. I know that Hugh Ross and the like have fans among this congregation. But they too, I think, misuse scripture, trying to force it and read it scientifically and find a way in which they can read Genesis 1 scientifically that supports their view. So let me say a few words about science. It is important to distinguish three elements: facts, interpretations, and presuppositions. The facts or the data cannot be denied. If they are wrong, they are not really facts or data. We say, just the facts, ma'am, but that's a myth. Rarely are we content with mere facts. Rarely are they what we actually want to know. Rarely are they what we actually have. As inquisitive creatures, we seek explanations. But our interpretations are greatly influenced by the presuppositions we bring to the facts. Evolution, though it is frequently called a fact, is not a fact. It is an interpretation, albeit a widely accepted one. Indeed, it is the best interpretation of the data for those who hold certain presuppositions. More than that, it is the only acceptable interpretation for those who hold certain presuppositions. On the other hand, we have to admit that certain processes seem clear on the micro level. There is adaptation and survival of the fittest to natural selection. The biotech industry, which has a great presence here in the Bay Area and in which a number of you work in research, depends upon these things happening. But at the macro level, things are a lot more sketchy. So among my own presuppositions that I bring to bear upon thinking about facts, they include, in the beginning, God, faith seeking understanding, and that Genesis 1 is not a science book. What is needed on both sides is a major dose of humility. Evolutionists need to admit that they are far from a complete explanation, that there are many oddities that don't fit. But creationists also need humility. They need to read Genesis 1 with humble wonder as poetry, rather than shrilly insisting on its incorporation into school curriculum as a scientific textbook. They too need to admit that there are things we don't fully understand yet, that our understanding is still provisional. But it's not a debate about facts. It's a debate about interpretations placed upon those facts based upon presuppositions. I don't know how God made the world. Genesis 1 only simply tells me that he made it. I seek understanding, but I do so from a position of faith. And that's a basic presupposition of mine. So what do I see when I read the first 3 days as poetry? Well, I see that God brings order to his world and does so by his word. Why do I believe that he did this in the beginning? Because I see him continuing to do this throughout history, speaking order into chaos, light into darkness, form into formlessness. This is the way God works. In the prologue to John's Gospel, Jesus is portrayed as both the Word and the Light. Jesus was God's final prophet, whom he sent to his people. But he was also the Word proclaimed. He was both message and messenger. Into a world of darkness, God sent his Son as the Light. But the world preferred to live in darkness and put out that light. Nevertheless, God continues to send his light into the world, not allowing darkness to prevail. What a great word that word nevertheless is. Even though the world put out the light, nevertheless, God continues to shine light into this world through his Spirit, bringing the resurrection life of his Son to broken, disordered, dark lives. Back in 1984, Gordon MacDonald wrote a book, Ordering Your Private World, after his own world fell apart. It obviously touched a nerve in people because it sold over 1 million copies. Many people feel that their lives are disordered. They are seeking order for them. God doesn't promise us life, liberty, and happiness. But he is at work shining light into darkness, speaking order into disorder, bringing formation to formlessness. As we read in 2 Corinthians 4, God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. God, who first shone light into darkness on day one, now shines the light of his Son into our lives through his Spirit. Notice that in our window, the sun in the first bay and the dove in the third bay are at the same level. I did this in order to draw attention to this parallel, that God, who spoke light into the world in the beginning, now shines his light into the world through his Spirit, infusing the world with the resurrection life of his Son. See, Jesus is the light of the world, and God, through his Spirit, shines that light into our dark lives. But then that third panel continues. The Spirit shines that light into our lives and then through us into the world beyond. Because we are now the light of the world, sent out into the world to bring light to darkness. But there is more yet to come. In the first 3 days, God spoke into existence a formed, ordered, structured world. Starting with just darkness and sea, his word drove back the darkness and sea as order emerged. The darkness and sea remained, though they were on the periphery. Within this world, there is now space and time. Space, there is spatial differentiation between what is ordered and what is not yet fully ordered. There is temporal differentiation within the time. And God saw that this was all very good, that it was very good. He was content for it to be that way. Light amidst darkness, land amidst sea. But in the new heavens and the new earth, there will be no more sea, no more darkness. All will be fully ordered. Space and time, as we currently understand them, will cease. There will be no more spatial separation, no more temporal separation. The story begins with a lack of differentiation. All is darkness and sea. And it ends with a lack of differentiation. But the complete opposite. The darkness and sea have been completely removed. All is light and all is solid land. So I read Genesis 1, not as a science book, but as poetry. And as I savor this account, I am formed in my understanding of God, of the world, of myself, of others. God is effortlessly sovereign. He speaks, and it happens without a struggle. This world, though disordered now, is yielding to God's ordering. I look forward to the day when all will be ordered in the new heavens and the new earth. But in the meantime, God is speaking order into my life and the lives of people throughout the world. Though we prefer darkness to his light, nevertheless, God is shining his light into our dark hearts. There is no heart so dark that God cannot shine his light into it. There is no life so chaotic and disordered that God cannot speak order into it. There is no personality so deformed that God cannot form it. In the Book of Common Prayer, there's a wonderful collect to recite together as part of evening prayer. Lighten our darkness, we beseech thee, O Lord. You see, that's how God works. Formation into formlessness. Genesis 1 is not a scientific textbook. It's part of our story of origins. It shapes how we view God, how we view the world, how we view ourselves, and how we view others. God is a God who speaks order. The world is in the process of being ordered. I am in the process of being ordered. And God is speaking through all of us to those around us who are in the process of being ordered. God is light, and he speaks that light into darkness. Thanks be to God. Well, we're going to sing a hymn now, Thou Lovely Source of True Delight. And its 6 verses tell a story of a Christian who ends up with his soul in disarray, feeling disorder. And then in the 5th verse, cries out to God, Jesus, my Lord, my life, my light, O come with blissful ray, break radiant through the shades of night, and chase my fears away. And we call out for God to break radiant through our remaining darknesses, the dark corners of our life, and complete that work of formation. So then we can sing with verse 6, Then shall my soul with rapture trace the wonders of thy love, but the full glories of thy face are only known above.